it's necessary in order to try and correct this massive imbalance with China.
Trading tariffs and words among goods and services. It's Tuesday, June 19th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, the United Nations looks at Kashmir human rights for the first time. An Australian state moves toward equality. Tariffs hit a tasty portion of the U.S. economy. Tough bacteria and bee drones. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The state-run China Daily said China's decision to slap a retaliatory 25% tariff on hundreds of U.S. goods worth $50 billion should remind the U.S. government, quote, that the trade war that it has initiated has a price tag. China's new duties will cover American agricultural, automotive, and aquatic products and follows the Trump administration's announcement Friday it will impose 25% tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods in July. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty President Donald Trump's decision is long overdue.
I think any administration, any president should have done exactly what Mr. Trump is doing, but he should have done it 10, 20 years ago. Letting China into the World Trade Organization in the early 90s was a strategic disaster for the United States. They were let in without the requirement to follow the rules that everyone else had to follow. The belief of America's ruling class, and that's how I would put it, both in the business and government sectors, was that by accommodating China, China would gradually liberalize, would gradually become a more democratic, peaceful country, and would play by the rules. That has been proven to be wrong. And even people now who were responsible for this are starting to admit that 20 years later, that this didn't turn out the way it was supposed to be. So I think it's overdue for Mr. Trump to take these steps, and I suspect this is just the first step.
But is he going to alienate the very people who voted him into office by causing tariffs and huge cost increases to American companies?
Well, there's always that risk. But one thing that you'll find is that the tariffs he's put on, and hopefully the tariffs are, once again, are just the start. But you're going to find people who benefit from a more aggressive, or actually more responsible approach towards Chinese really improper, illegal behavior on the trade front. So there's trade-offs, of course. Some people, some businesses may suffer, but others will benefit from this. But this is long overdue, as I said. It's the equivalent of going to the dentist after you've put it off for 15, 20 years. It's going to be painful. But also keep in mind that China does need a lot of these things that they've put tariffs on themselves. They're going to need oil from somewhere. They're going to need American grain, American food. They're going to need to get it somewhere. So if they don't buy it from America, America will probably sell it to the people who sell it to China. But there is no easy way out of this. And this is once again, it's long overdue, and it's is not going to be easy. And this is what comes of allowing this kind of situation to develop.
Aren't tariffs counterintuitive to free trade?
It's necessary in order to try and correct this massive imbalance with China. It's not a question of trade deficit so much, but rather it's one set of rules that have applied to China and not to the United States. So China gets this special treatment, and it has allowed them to undercut U.S. businesses, to really hollow out our manufacturing industries. And also, I would complicit in this would be what I would refer to as America's CEO and MBA class that have chased this lure of the Chinese market, this lure of cheap labor costs, and really sacrificed their own American customers in the process.
Grant Newsham said the U.S. is seeking reciprocity. American companies should be able to do in China what Chinese companies are permitted to do in the United States. He said a bilateral consensus agreement reached in May did not address the structural problems in Chinese trade policy. Newsham said the goal should be to inflict enough pain on the ruling Chinese Communist Party so it eventually complies with global trade rules. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOANews.com. Deadly earthquake hits western Japan. South Korea flexible on ending joint U.S. military drills. Sino-Philippine fishing deal would go a long way, experts say. Cambodian prince hurt in car accident. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A 49-page report by the UN Human Rights Office details mass human rights violations and abuses spanning 7 decades of conflict in Indian-administered and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. This is the first UN report to examine the human rights situation in this volatile region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report decries the suffering of millions of people who have been victimized by the brutality and abuse committed by both Indian and Pakistani security forces on both sides of the line of control in Kashmir. It highlights a situation of chronic impunity for violations, which continue to rob people of the justice they deserve for the atrocities they have had to endure for decades. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad al-Hussein says any resolution to Kashmir's long-standing political crisis must entail accountability for the crimes committed and must provide redress for the victims.
So that's why I will be urging the UN Human Rights Council to consider establishing a commission of inquiry to conduct a comprehensive, independent, international investigation into allegations of human rights violations in Kashmir.
The report mainly focuses on the human rights situation in the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir from July 2016 to April 2018. This period was marked by large and unprecedented demonstrations, which erupted after Indian security forces killed the leader of an armed group. The report estimates Indian security forces killed up to 145 civilians and armed groups killed up to 20 civilians during the same period. Zayed notes a law enacted in 1990 prohibits prosecution of security forces, granting them virtual impunity for human rights violations.
There is almost total impunity for enforced or involuntary disappearances, with little movement towards credibly investigating complaints, including into alleged sites of mass graves. There is also chronic impunity for sexual violence in Kashmir, both for incidents allegedly carried out by security forces and by armed groups.
The report cites evidence of a wide range of human rights abuses, including kidnappings and killings of civilians and sexual violence committed by armed groups that have operated in Jammu and Kashmir since the late 1980s. India accuses Pakistan of supporting these groups to stoke unrest in the territory, a charge categorically denied by the Pakistan government. India strongly rejected the report, dismissing it as a selective compilation of largely unverified information. It calls the report fallacious, tendentious, and motivated, and questions why the High Commissioner's office would bring out such a report. Pakistan did not immediately comment on the report. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, a state of emergency has been declared in Papua New Guinea after rioting in the remote Pacific Islands' Southern Highlands province. Angry demonstrators looted and set fire to several buildings in the provincial capital of Mendi last week, including the residence of the governor. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The Australian state of Victoria has taken the first official step towards signing a treaty with its Aboriginal peoples. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us it's the first time any Australian parliament has passed laws that commit to a future accord with Indigenous groups.
Aboriginal leaders hope a treaty with the state of Victoria will deliver political and economic benefits. The vote in state parliament is the first step in what could be a long process, but campaigners have said it was a watershed moment. The Northern Territory and Western Australia have also promised similar action towards their own treaties with Indigenous tribes. Critics have argued, however, that efforts should focus on a national Aboriginal accord rather than individual state agreements. But Pat Dodson, an Indigenous senator for Western Australia, is happy that progress is finally being made.
This is something we have to solve if we're going to have honour and integrity as a nation, as well as bring about justice and recognition and respect for the First Nations people.
Talk of treaties with Indigenous Australia isn't new. In 1988, former Australian Prime Minister Bob Hawke promised a treaty with the nation's original inhabitants.
There shall be a treaty negotiated between the Aboriginal people and the government on behalf of all the people of Australia.
But the former Prime Minister's promise wasn't fulfilled because of various concerns over the implications of an official accord, including financial compensation. Australia is the only Commonwealth country, a grouping of nations with ties to the former British Empire, that doesn't have a treaty with its original inhabitants. Canada and New Zealand have formal agreements with their Indigenous peoples that include compensation for past injustices as well as land and fishing rights. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of the country's population and suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Campaigners believe a formal treaty could provide practical help in areas such as health and education. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Meanwhile, in Indonesia, a high-flying Eid celebration tradition was partially grounded, as we hear from VOA's Penny Dixon.
Balloons, along with fireworks, have long been part of festivities like Eid in Indonesia, which is home to the world's largest Muslim population. But with modern materials and designs, they've become much bigger. The Transportation Ministry says some balloons are up to 10 meters in diameter and more than 20 meters high, and warned of penalties Monday. Air Transportation Director General Agus Santoso said some balloons had been reaching cruise altitude at level of 10,000 meters above sea level. The Transportation Ministry issued its statement after pilots sighted dozens of balloons in the skies over the archipelago in the days after Eid, which fell on Friday in Indonesia this year. Most of the sightings were over the provinces of Central and East Java. Novi Rianto is the head of AirNav Indonesia. Rianto said the balloons posed a very significant hazard, and there had been 84 sightings over the weekend, prompting complaints from dozens of domestic and international pilots. He said in a statement, "Yesterday a great deal of traffic could not travel on routes and had to ascend to avoid these balloons." Rianto added that the airspace over Java was the fifth most crowded in the world and served as an international crossing. As a result of the balloons, AirNav Indonesia had blocked off part of that air corridor for other aircraft, calling it a major disruption. Indonesia has a patchy air safety record. According to the Aviation Safety Network website, there were 12 accidents in 2016 in which 30 people died. Santoso urged the public to follow rules that balloons must be tethered and flown at a maximum height of 150 meters or lower near airports. A spokesman said via text message that police in East Java had confiscated 43 balloons before they could be launched. Penny Dixon, VOA News.
Coming up, new tariffs may drive some people to stop drinking. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, at least 3 people are dead, 90 others injured after a strong earthquake struck western Japan Monday. The Japan Meteorological Agency said the magnitude 6.1 quake struck just north of the country's second largest city of Osaka around 8 a.m. local time, just as commuters were beginning their rush hour. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, and the trade dispute escalates between the United States and its global trading partners, American bourbon whiskey is among the U.S. exports in the crosshairs. It will soon be subject to a 25% tariff imposed by a growing number of countries as a retaliatory measure for U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, the retaliation is a blow to smaller craft distilleries in the United States trying to expand overseas.
Distilling spirits is in Paul Hletko's DNA.
Prior to World War II, my grandfather's family owned what is now a major brewery in the Czech Republic.
His grandfather's Jewish family lost more than a brewery when the Nazis took over Europe during the war.
The whole family got taken to the camps where they were all murdered, except for my grandfather. But he spent the rest of his life trying to get the brewery back and never did. And when he died, it struck me that if I didn't do something to reconnect and reengage with the family legacy, it's going to be gone forever.
Welcome to Few Spirits in Evanston, Illinois. Pletko's homage to his family. Only this time around, he's not in the beer business.
Whiskey's what beer wants to be when it grows up.
Pletko's whiskey is now in demand at home and abroad.
But we're sold across 35 countries and about 45 states. We're the number one American craft spirit in the United Kingdom.
But the real prize for Hletko is China.
U.S. spirits exports to China have gone up something like 2,000%. And that's a hell of a number.
A number that may sharply decline as another war, this time a trade war, could once again derail the Hletko family business. Tariffs proposed by several key U.S. trading partners, including China, threaten sales of American products like Fuse Bourbon.
Proposed tariffs are roughly 25%, which would be a very dramatic increase and make our products, which are already relatively expensive, unnecessarily more expensive.
But it's the iconic American brands that they're going. It's not just bourbon. It's because bourbon is America.
Market analyst and Fox Business Network contributor Phil Flynn downplays the impact of tariffs on bourbon sales overseas, particularly in China.
It's not like they're banning the sales of these things. It's just going to be a little bit more expensive. But generally speaking, if you have a good quality product and it comes from overseas, you're going to probably pay a little more.
But Paul Hletko says it affects his bottom line and would significantly cut into his modest annual sales to China.
We are currently estimating that our $150,000 will likely go down to somewhere around $5,000 or $10,000, virtually eliminating it.
And with it, other American jobs.
All of those exports are American jobs that are, you know, making it, growing the grain, moving the grain, doing the boxes. Everybody is benefiting from U.S. exports to China. I, for one, would like to be able to see that continue to grow.
Without that growth, Hletko says what is now a potential loss of hundreds of thousands of dollars for Few Spirits this year could translate into millions of dollars of lost future profit if foreign consumers turn away from a product they view as too costly.
We're simply a pawn in a political game.
A game which Hletko says crowns no real winners. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Evanston, Illinois.
This news from VOA Asia, Cambodia's Prince Norodom Ranariddh was seriously injured, his wife killed, in a car crash Sunday in a southwestern coastal city. Prince Ranariddh's sports utility vehicle was hit head-on by a taxi driving in the opposite direction. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, scientists say due to indiscriminate use of antibiotics for treating even minor infections, many bacteria have developed strong immunity against this type of drug. In their words, we may have already entered the post-antibiotic era, with previously non-life-threatening infections becoming fatal. Researchers at Rockefeller University in New York say an enzyme called lysin may prove to be crucial in this new battle against infection, as we hear from VOA's George Pudich.
Every year, about 700,000 people around the world die from infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and that number keeps rising. Experts say if we do not find effective new drugs, by 2050, the number of deaths could reach 10 million. One course of action is to develop viruses called phages that attack a specific strain of bacteria, for instance, Staphylococcus aureus, that causes a range of hard-to-treat infections. Crucial for this method is an enzyme called lysin.
When you take that purified enzyme and add it back to a bacteria, for example, in an infection, it will drill a hole in the cell wall, the membrane externalizes like it would normally do, explode, and kill the organism instantly.
After 20 years of research, Fischetti managed to extract lysin from a bacteria-eating phage, so the normally harmless virus itself is not used in the treatment, eliminating the danger it could mutate into a harmful form.
This is just a different way of killing bacteria. People are not comfortable with it yet, but I think once the first lysin gets through phase two clinical trials to show that it actually works and works well, people will be more comfortable with it, and I think we'll start using lysins in addition to antibiotics.
Biotechnology company Contrafact successfully completed phase one of clinical tests with a lysin called CF301 on healthy volunteers infected with Staph aureus. The phase two trial is underway.
We're very encouraged by what we've seen because it tells us that we can use the lysin in addition to conventional small molecule antibiotics, completely different mechanism of action without any observable adverse events.
In the meantime, researchers are trying to develop a lysin that will have the same effect on a different strain of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that causes hospital-acquired pneumonia. George Putic, VOA News.
Despite astonishing advances in robotics, today's machines often struggle to accomplish what insects do routinely. So robotics researchers are taking advantage of nature's billions of years of experience. They're learning from bees to build flying machines that can learn and navigate their environments. VOA's Steve Barragona is buzzing with details.
Their brains may be tiny, but bees can do a lot more than today's drones, says Alex Dewar at the University of Sussex.
An individual forager is capable of going out and exploring her environment, learning her environment, and finding a patch of flowers and foraging and coming home again. And then she can go on to communicate this information to other individuals and so on.
Dewar says a drone with that kind of deep learning computing power would need a heavy battery.
If you put additional weight on it, it makes it much more difficult to control. It requires more power and so on. So the idea behind the project is, can we learn something from honeybees in particular in terms of power-efficient strategies for carrying out autonomous behaviors?
The Brains on Board project is studying insect brains and insect behaviors to use as models for intelligent drones. For example, programmers could learn from the way bees map their surroundings, says University of Sussex biorobotics professor Andy Filippides.
They'll do big loops around their nest that will serve to help them learn the environment so they can get back on the very first time. So that's kind of the next stage, is to look at how we can use behaviors we give the robot to enable it to structure the information that's coming in so that it makes the world easier to learn and easier to navigate.
The project brings together biologists and experts in machine learning and robotics.
We're studying the bee at multiple scales. So we've got VR, virtual reality arena, where we can record what's going on in the neuron, so very low scale. We've also got the higher up scale, the radar experiments. So we've got behavior and neural recordings. And then we've got the modeling expertise to be able to put that together.
The team hopes to have a robot drone flying autonomously within a year. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Of course, you can hear us online. We're all over the place. Many ways you can hear us streaming: VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com, are great places to hear our program. but so is the radio. If you happen to be out and about throughout the Asia region, check us out on many great radio stations, like Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. And as always, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Greg Burns, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.